Good morning and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar this morning. This is Your Call. By now you've heard in the early morning hours of Monday, a heavily armed gunman killed 49 people, wounded 53 others in a packed gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. This latest horrific tragedy is the worst mass shooting in U.S. history. Just when you think you've heard that again for the last time, then again, more hyperbole. This, in fact, is the worst in history. A few hours after that massacre, President Obama said, "This is an especially heartbreaking day for all of our friends, our fellow Americans who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender." And the president talked about how easy it is for people to get their hands on guns in America. He was clearly frustrated. This was the 15th time that he's had to stand at a podium to express sadness after a mass shooting. According to the president, quote, "We have to decide if that's the kind of country we want to be, and to actively do nothing is a decision as well." Since that mass shooting, there have been marches for peace and repeated calls for gun control. So, what do you think about the tragedy in Florida? How do we begin to react to this senseless act of violence on the LGBT community? If history is any predictor, this won't be the last time that we will witness the killing of innocents. So, what's the best way forward? And what would it take to change gun policy in our country? Is this the turning point? We hope you'll join our conversation today. 866-798-TALK. 866-798-8255. Send us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We are opening the phones today so that you can have your say on this issue. Everywhere I went yesterday, this is all people were talking about. We want to make sure that we get your reaction, but we're going to start with a national perspective on this. On the phone, we have Trevor Aronson. Trevor is a contributing writer at The Intercept and the executive director of the nonprofit Florida Center for Investigative Reporting. Trevor is also the author of The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terrorism. We think Trevor is a perfect person to start the conversation today. Welcome back, Trevor. Thanks for being here today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the latest. President Obama faced the press corps this morning with the latest. He was briefed by James Comey, the FBI director, and the president said that the shooter, 29-year-old Omar Mateen, was likely inspired by extremist videos on the internet. Inspired, but not directed. What's the difference?
Right. So the difference is that the Islamic State has really taken on the Al-Qaeda's previous playbook, which was that because of the heightened level of scrutiny of international communications after 9/11, it became increasingly difficult for a terrorist organization like an Al-Qaeda to coordinate with people in the United States to move forward in an attack like we saw on 9/11, for example. So as a result of that increased scrutiny and increased investigations and surveillance, Al-Qaeda moved to what became an inspirational model. That is that they went online and they posted videos and propaganda in the hopes of inspiring someone already in the United States or already in Europe to commit some sort of act of violence that they wouldn't necessarily know about prior to that act, but once it happened, they could then claim credit for it. And so what the FBI has for more than a decade feared is the increasing threat of so-called lone wolf terrorists, like what presumably Omar Mateen was, which is someone who may not have actually been in contact with the Islamic State or with a terrorist organization, but consumed the propaganda and watched the videos and became inspired to act inspired to act by them and then give credit to that organization when he leveled his attack. And as you can imagine, the challenge in something like this is finding the people who would want to do this, because it's difficult to separate people who are watching these videos and reading the propaganda online, you know, journalists like me do that every day, but we don't go out and commit violence. At the same time, there are a small group of people, actually very small if you think about it, who do consume that material and do go out and commit violence and then credit it to a terrorist organization, in this case the Islamic State. And so when the FBI or government officials talk about inspirational attack, what they mean is that in all likelihood this person really wasn't in contact with the terrorist organization, but was acting in out of inspiration from material that that terrorist organization produced online.
Well, and yet, Trevor, there appeared to have been some red flags. He was contacted twice by the FBI and interviewed. So clearly he came up on the radar. He was a member of a mosque where a terrorist from the United States traveled to the Middle East and became a suicide bomber. Some of Martine's co-workers said that he was making incendiary remarks. So where were the cracks? What cracks did he slip through?
Yeah, I mean, so what he is a testament to is that dangerous people can easily slip through this very vast FBI counterterrorism dragnet that was created after 9/11. And you're right. What we know about Omar Mateen so far is that he was investigated twice by the FBI. First, after he claimed to have some knowledge and relationship with the Boston Marathon bombers, the FBI opened an investigation and then closed it. And then, secondly, he claimed to have a friendship with a man from Florida who became the first suicide bomber in Syria for al-Nusra Front, or the first American-born suicide bomber for al-Nusra. And they investigated him then. And yet, in both of those cases, they ultimately closed the case. And I talked to FBI agents about this, and this is a real sticking point. I mean, what FBI agents will complain about is that there's a lot of pressure from within the system that unless they have what they consider articulable information, that information that this person is going to commit some sort of act of violence, they have trouble keeping the file open on him. And in this case, they may have found information that this person, Omar Mateen, knew someone related to terrorism or someone who had gone over to fight in Syria. But if they couldn't prove more than that relationship and the fact that maybe he likes to go online and look at jihadi websites, that might not have been enough to keep the investigation open, because there is pressure to show results, like with any law enforcement agency. You know, my criticism, and a story I wrote for The Intercept yesterday, was pointing out that, you know, while people like Omar Mateen are able to slip past the FBI dragnet, and also it's worth noting that, you know, Tomlin Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber, slipped through the dragnet in the same way, the FBI spends an awful lot of time, you know, building sting operations against people who are of very questionable capacity. You know, at the time that Mateen was not under investigation by the FBI in Florida, the Miami FBI had launched a year-long investigation on this man named James Medina, who was a homeless man who didn't have connections to international terrorists, had no weapons, and it was actually the FBI informant who came up with the idea of crediting their supposed attack on the Islamic State. And, you know, so there is a question of whether the FBI, in its kind of demand to show results and build cases, is finding kind of this low-hanging fruit, these guys that are easily manipulated by informants and undercover agents and sting operations, but at the same time then is unable to identify people like Tomlin Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber, or Omar Mateen, the Orlando shooter, before they have an opportunity to do significant violence.
Trevor Aronson, writer for The Intercept, thank you for being here today to give us sort of the macro picture. And we want to bring it down to the local level as well and welcome your calls. We want to say hi and thank you for joining us, Carlo Uribe, who's the co-chair of the Oakland Pride Organization. He's joining us for local reaction. Hi, Carlos. Thanks for being there today.
Hello, thank you for having me on.
And we want you to join the conversation, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Is there anything we can do in light of living in an open society? How do you prevent a lone wolf attack on soft targets. Was the gay community specifically targeted in this? And what does that mean, given that we live in San Francisco with a healthy, active gay community? Are we in particular danger? Carlos, I'm going to pose that question to you and invite you to talk about how the gay community and supporters here in the Bay Area have reacted to the shootings in Orlando.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I think they reacted the only way we could react, with love and support for our community. Being able to come together last night at the vigil, we had hundreds out there until, you know, out late after 10 o'clock at Oakland City Hall. And I know there were many more in San Francisco, in San Francisco's Castro neighborhood, that just came out and showed support, just came out and showed, you know, love and community, and really started the healing process. And I think that is a huge thing to help move us forward. You know, and it also sends the message of our community is strong. Our community will band together and, you know, is not going to tolerate, you know, incidents like this. You know, the question about are we safe, or are we any more of a target here in the Bay Area? You know, because, you know, we are out and we are very open, especially here in the Bay Area. I would say I don't necessarily think so. You know, I have been an Oakland resident for 10 years now. I live in Oakland. I work in Oakland, and I feel safe in Oakland. I feel safe with my partner in Oakland. I feel safe going to the gay bars and gay establishments and gay friendly, you know, bars and establishments here in the city. And, you know, and I don't think it's necessarily that we see ourselves as targets, but, you know, there is a caution that I think we take with any place that we go to.
Well, I can't imagine whether or not, who knows, whether this was a specific attack based on the fact that this happened during Pride Month, which commemorates the Stonewall Riots in 1969 and the start of the gay movement in general. The fact that Santa Monica police arrested a man who had automatic weapons and the makings of explosives, and when he was stopped, he said he was on his way to the L.A. Pride Parade. How do you even begin to move through life feeling safe, Carlos, given that?
Well, I think we don't necessarily have a choice. You know, we can choose to live in fear and you know, wait for things like that to happen, or we can choose to embrace love and embrace life and really move past that. You know, I think honestly it is a sign and an indication of, you know, of how we raised our children. You know, children 15, 20 years ago were growing up not seeing positive examples of the LGBTQ community on television and in the media, and, you know, especially from politicians and elected officials. I myself grew up, you know, very traditional Catholic, with, you know, the opinion that the LGBT community was not a very good place. And when we put those values into our children and they grow up in a confused society. You know, folks who are now in their 20s and 30s and 40s who grew up with this rhetoric are confused, I think, are seeing that, you know, our society as a whole is moving, and the needle has moved more towards, you know, tolerance and acceptance, and I think it takes an adjustment, you know. And so now during Pride Month, yes, absolutely, we, you know, the LGBT community, the LGBTQ community is out there in force. You know, more cities across the country and across the world are celebrating Pride, are having their own Pride celebrations. And, you know, I think that raises our awareness, that it raises our visibility. And, you know, perhaps I'm honestly not sure, but maybe that does raise the threat and the danger a little of some backlash. But I think that this is a bigger conversation to have, not necessarily just about the LGBTQ community, but about, you know, gun access in the United States.
Well, I noticed that members of the Muslim religious community were quick to come to the microphones. Imams quickly all across the country expressed their condolences to the families and quickly separated traditional Islam from so-called radical Islam. And, of course, those semantics are in play in our politics today. Trevor, because of the religion of the shooter, is there a fear that people in the Muslim community could be targeted, and to what extent would that lead to further problems, and to what extent does the greater Muslim community actually act as a bulwark against this kind of radical behavior?
Right. I mean, I think what we saw very dramatically was that the Muslim community came out very quickly and in coalition with LGBT groups and others in kind of condemning the violence that happened. And I think what groups like the Council on American Islamic Relations here in Florida and others are really concerned about is obviously this really horrible attack takes place at a time of really unprecedented Islamophobia, where you have, a major party presidential candidate, talking about banning all Muslims from entering the United States. And what Muslim communities across the country, including Florida, talk of is increasing harassment, increasing vandalism at mosques. And the concern, I think, for the Muslim community is that, people who don't really understand the religion might think that someone like Omar Mateen, represents, the millions of Muslims living in the United States. And for that reason, they would kind of pursue some sort of vigilante justice. And what you're seeing is, I think, a very kind of wise move by the Muslim community in saying, like, look, here we are, we're a part of this community too, and we are mourning with you, and we are condemning this violence, and we're here to help, as opposed to staying silent and fearing that the message will be dictated by someone else, by, the Donald Trumps of the world. And I think, I think what you're seeing more and more is it's unfortunate that Muslim groups have to apologize for the violence of people who are acting in the name of their faith but not following that faith. I mean, certainly, Christian groups are never ones to come forward and condemn the acts of a, abortion clinic bomber, for example. But, the world, I think, that Muslims are living in today is one that is fairly Islamophobic and fairly irrational. And I think they feel wisely a need to get out in front of this and say, this kind of act is not done in the religion that we follow.
Well, certainly politics has now entered the discussion about this incident. Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, prompted some outrage Sunday. He tweeted that he appreciates the congrats for being right on Islamic terror. And he followed that up with another calling on President Obama to resign if he doesn't say the words radical Islamic terrorism. And just this morning, presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, she said, okay, I'll just say the words, radical Islamic terrorism. Is it just semantics, Trevor, or does it matter how this issue is framed?
I mean, I think it's both of those things. I mean, to a certain extent, it is fairly semantical. I mean, what does it really mean? But at the same time, there is a double standard. When a Christian commits acts of violence in the name of their religion, it wasn't long ago, I think less than a year, that man in Colorado shot up a Planned Parenthood in the name of Christianity. You don't hear people asking Christians to condemn those acts, and you don't hear people refer to radical Christianity. I think the term kind of radical Islamism and kind of radical Islam has taken on a real political persona beyond just what it means. And I think when it's used by people like Donald Trump, it's used in a very wide swath to say that, hey, look, there's something wrong with this religion, that the religion is the problem, and that all Muslims, therefore, are to be suspect and be concerned. And I think where you're finding kind of Hillary Clinton hedge a little bit is in recognizing that, but at the same time realizing that, politically she has to talk about what some people perceive as the problem, that, the violence is being committed in the name of Islam, right? That said, though, had this been a white man who, for his Christian faith got an AR assault rifle and killed these people in a gay club because they are gay, that would be labeled a hate crime, but not necessarily a religiously focused one. And so there certainly are kind of double standards at play, when it comes to violence committed by Muslims compared to violence committed by non-Muslims, and this kind of idea that of the radical theology, it becomes much more prevalent when it's a Muslim than when it's a Christian.
We're still looking at motives. Apparently, in his words today, the president indicated that a motive is not clear, and yet yesterday reporting was that the shooter's father indicated that his son was in Miami on a visit with his young son and witnessed two men kissing and touching each other on the sidewalk. And his father indicated that he was outraged by this and says, "I can't believe they're doing this in front of my son," and that that may very well have been one of the reasons that he targeted this particular nightclub. Carlos Uribe, what are you hearing from people in the LGBT community in Florida and across the country about the extent to which they feel more vulnerable? There's been so much discussion lately about transgender bathroom use and gay marriage, and these issues have been percolating up to the top of our political discussions. To what extent is the gay community nationwide looking at how this elevated discussion of these issues may, in fact, put them in the crosshairs?
Yeah, it's a very good question. You know, I've immediately when I found out about this, I placed phone calls, sent emails, you know, reached out on Facebook to friends and family across the country that, you know, I knew may be affected by this or, you know, maybe involved. And, you know, I think the overall response to any situation like this, to any mass shooting, to any, you know, tragedy is, you know, a natural vulnerability. You know, you do feel attacked, you do feel more put out in the open there. But I think in the same sense, the response from both within the LGBTQ community and just the community overall, the Oakland community here, the San Francisco community, just the Bay Area, and cities across the country has been overwhelmingly positive. You know, I witnessed last night, you know, people walking each other to their cars, you know, people really embracing and holding hands and being out and being comfortable and feeling safe. You know, I think, like I said, I do think this opens up just a natural vulnerability, but I think it's one that is just fresh and, you know, part of the situation that happened, part of the tragedy. But I do think it's one that we will move on past.
Well, we've certainly had discussions about gun control or strengthening laws, but how do you even begin to do that when Congress, Trevor, is stuck on the idea of whether or not it's okay for someone who's on the terror watch list to purchase a gun? What's the starting point for the conversation going forward as it relates to gun safety laws?
Right. So I think it's worth pointing out that just a few days ago before the shooting, President Obama had made a remark about how, daily his national security staff comes to him and they can tell them very specifically about people in the United States going to websites and consuming, Islamic State propaganda or communicating on Islamic State related websites, and that he is unable to stop them or put them on any sort of list that would prevent them from buying firearms. Because of the current laws that have largely been lobbied for by groups like the NRA. You know, by contrast, the government, when, you know, someone like Omar Mateen, if they were suspicious of him and they felt that he could do violence, you know, they can very easily and without much ability for Omar Mateen to appeal, you know, put him on a no-fly list or put him on a secondary screening list at the airport. And, you know, I have colleagues and friends who are Muslim who talk to me about how they've, you know, have secondary screenings and they're trying to get off of it. And it's a very kind of, it's a process that the government uses against people that they're suspicious of. And it's very difficult to get off of that. By contrast, though, the government has, an inability to stop someone like Omar Mateen, who has been under investigation for suspected terrorists, from buying weapons. And, you know, there's a question not only of, you know, from a legal perspective and a regulatory perspective, whether we should begin to link the terrorist watch list to an ability to purchase firearms, but also if there might, for example, be just too much information in the system. I mean, part of the government's problem in kind of its collected all process in counterterrorism is that even if there were a system in place where they could be notified that Omar Mateen just bought a gun, and Omar Mateen is someone who is to be suspicious of, you know, he's among thousands of people that they would currently be watching, would that have created actionable intelligence for the government? And I think that's another question that would have to be raised. But I mean, certainly I think, you know, from a public policy standpoint, it makes a lot of sense that there would be an extra layer of scrutiny for someone buying a firearm if they are on the terrorism watch list. And right now that isn't the case. And I'm not sure that most Americans realize that you could be under investigation for terrorism and the federal government, the ATF, the FBI can do nothing if you walk into a gun store like Omar Mateen did and buy an AR-57 assault rifle. I mean, that's perfectly within the means and the law for people in the United States today.
And something I'm sure that will be revisited again and again in the days to come. And one of the things we want to discuss going forward in this half hour coming up, Trevor Aronson is a writer for The Intercept, and Carlos Uribe is co-chair of the Oakland Pride Organization. If you will both stay with us, we're going to take your calls right after this break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. Coming up in a half hour, it's Reveal from the Center for Independent Reporting. Center for Investigative Reporting, Al Edson and the team look into PCBs. We thought they were banned about 40 years ago. Why are they making school children sick? We'll hear about that 11 o'clock, half hour from now, here on KALW.
In our clubs, we used to black out the windows so that people wouldn't see who was going in and who was going out. We used the back door. We're not using the goddamn back door anymore.
Latinos are very afraid to come out of their closet, in fear to lose their community and their families, in fear to lose their loved ones. Some of these men were undocumented, so their families may not be able to come and support them or be present for them or be able to bury them. It is hard to be a minority within a minority.
When Martin Luther King was killed, somebody thought that when you kill the messenger, you kill the message. That was a huge mistake because the message got greater and greater and greater. So here's my word to you. Go to all the pride parades here and wear your stuff and make your voice loud and declare that we shall not be moved.
For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. What you just heard were voices from last night's vigil in Oakland, standing in solidarity with those suffering across the country, and particularly those in Orlando, Florida. What you heard were the voices of Amber Todd, Alejandra Gavia, and Bishop Yvette Flunder. They were at last night's Oakland Out for Orlando vigil. Thanks to Allison Levitsky of KALW News for bringing those voices to us. We're podcasting this show, and you can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can find past shows there as well and find out what's coming up next. Briefly, let's just give you an idea of what's coming up tomorrow. We'll have a conversation with award-winning journalist Ben Ehrenreich about his new book, The Way to the Spring. It's based on his reporting from the West Bank. This is a deeply personal account of his time spent with families under occupation in the West Bank. We hope you'll join us tomorrow on Your Call. Back to today. If you have a show idea for us, by the way, drop a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. 8255. We've got a couple of callers on the line who want to weigh in today. Let's go to Michael calling from Boston. Hi, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I think on the one hand, it's sort of a two-sided problem with the Second Amendment. And on one side, the Supreme Court has recently ruled kind of anomalously that it's about a personal right to own a gun, and that feeds into the American cult of masculinity. And there are many people for whom owning a gun is this weird badge of being a man. And I don't know what to do about that. But on the other side, the Second Amendment is there so that well-regulated militias for self-protection under the rule of law can be formed. And if it gets much worse, I think that's something the LGBTQ community really should start considering doing. I'm not talking about vigilantes. I'm talking about people who get together, who drill, who learn how to use their weapons properly, and more importantly, when to. And that's the proper place of the Second Amendment. And finally, I realize I'm spouting a bit, but wouldn't it be nice if there were no Islam or Christianity or Judaism or Buddhism or Marxism or fascism for people to do these things in the name of? Yeah. I think it's time to put away childish things.
As John Lennon would say, imagine. Trevor Aronson, it is a point, actually. One of the things that Michael brought up was, what if the victims had been armed? He tweeted that, Donald Trump tweeted that just today, that the answer to gun violence is, in fact, more guns. And yet, my dad, when we were growing up in the late 60s, was part of a group of men in our neighborhood who patrolled that area because there had been bombings. I mean, you know, Birmingham was one of those places where African-American communities had to, in fact, arm themselves to protect themselves. So what do you say?
No, I mean, there is what the cliche that the best defense against a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, and I understand that, and I'm sympathetic to that idea. I guess what I would caution is that, you know, if we were to kind of go down that road and create more of a Wild West style culture in the United States as a whole, you know, when does the arms race stop? You know, because the bad guys have, you know, assault rifles, do the good guys carry them as well? You know, we're dealing with a gun industry today that it's very easy for people to buy weapons that are designed for the battlefield and only kind of nominally changed for the marketplace. In the case of, you know, the AR-57 assault rifles, my understanding is that you can buy them and that they're very easy to modify so that it allows for fully automatic shooting, and that basically you can buy from the store when slightly modified a gun that you would have normally on a battlefield. And my concern would be that, you know, we would essentially have an arms race among citizens. And, you know, frankly, that makes me personally uncomfortable. You know, I support the idea that the caller has that, you know, we have a constitutional right to arms, and that, you know, the founders of our country, you know, decided that for, to prevent, you know, government tyranny, that there would be a pressure release valve in these militias were they well regulated. But I certainly don't think that the founding fathers, you know, anticipated people coming into nightclubs with assault rifles and then having the patrons of the nightclubs respond in kind with their own assault rifles. I just don't think that's a very wise move. And moving in that direction would kind of put us down that very slippery slope.
Carlos Uribe, is it possible vigils become vigilantism? If people are really worried and concerned, is that even a possibility?
You know, I want to echo, you know, the sentiments that, you know, I don't think we should be, you know, approaching this thing of an arms race. I don't think, you know, we necessarily need to be there. I mean, yes, there was a time where, you know, you would go armed to a gay bar or a gay club, or, you know, you would make sure you had a knife in your back pocket, as I and I know many others have gone to. And, you know, unfortunately, I, you know, had to use that once in my life.
You did? Myself. Under what circumstances?
Yes. I was coming out of a club in Southern California. And, you know, I think I was 20, 21 at the time. And I was coming out of a club and I was approached by three men. And it was me and a friend I was with for the night. And, you know, we defended ourselves. And, you know, I was fortunate to walk away from there. You know, but we didn't report it to the cops. We didn't, you know, report it to anyone. We didn't say anything because, you know, at the time we didn't feel like it would have been heard. So in looking at that, having been someone, you know, who was in that situation, I don't think we need to return to a time of where we're going into our clubs armed. And I don't think it's a good idea because, you know, that's not the issue here. The issue here is not necessarily, you know, having to be armed to protect ourselves, but it's about us pushing as a community, you know, and pushing with other communities who have been doing this, you know, for so long, who have been affected by gun violence, you know, to help change the laws, to help change the policies that put us and put these situations and make these situations possible. I think that's the real piece here. You know, we as the LGBTQ community need to really, you know, band together and you know, work with other communities that are affected by gun violence. I think at this point every community has been affected by gun violence, and really change the narrative on gun control and the policies, you know, in our country.
The worst mass shooting in U.S. history, probably not the last time we're going to witness the killing of innocents. So what's the best way forward? What's it going to take to change gun policy in the U.S.? We invite your call, 866-798-8255. Let's go to June in Oakland. Good morning, June.
Good morning. Renee, I was calling because I had a couple of things that I wanted to say about this shooting. And first of all, I think this guy was really suffering from a lot of mental health issues. And sometimes what I think that he was confused about his own sexuality, and he was struggling with that, issues of his own sexuality. And for you to keep continuing to go to a place, you know, over and over, that's a sign that says something. And also, it's just, you know, these things are happening over and over again because people are not paying attention to the signs. And I am a strong Christian. I believe in Almighty God, and I believe in truth, hope, and faith, and sharing Christ and loving people. But, you know, a lot of this stems from religious and racial hatred in America and in the world, man's inhumanity to man. And I'm going to just say this. As long as African-American people, I know this story is about this particular person, but as long as African-American people are denied the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, these things are going to continue to happen. Because God is trying to reveal to us all these things that are happening in the world, all these floods, this hatred, this racial hatred. He's trying to tell us something, and we're not taking heed to the message.
Okay. Well, thank you. We appreciate that input. And once again, the issue of mental health comes into the discussion. We got input from Sarah in South San Francisco. She said, can't someone shut down these websites, these ISIS recruitment websites? She says, I'm Muslim, and there are lots of conversations happening in the Muslim community about this and how to prevent their sons and boys from becoming radicalized by groups like ISIS. Trevor, can you weigh in on how do you stop a website?
Yeah, I mean, you know, companies like Facebook and Twitter are pretty aggressive in shutting down accounts that are revealed to be linked to the Islamic State. But, you know, the more vexing problem for government authorities is most of these websites that people go to operate on in what's called the dark web, where it's not websites that are indexed by Google or that even can be accessed by, you know, Firefox or Chrome on your browser. You need to use what's called a Tor browser, and it kind of is this dark corner of the internet where, you know, these organizations are able to operate and communicate through various websites. And, you know, certainly the government plays a very active role in trying to shut them down. But, you know, as most people understand, I mean, you can move websites from server to server very quickly. And to a certain extent, this is a game of whack-a-mole for the government. And, you know, what the Islamic State has done even more effectively than Al-Qaeda is really use the dark web as an area to recruit people and kind of spread its really hateful message.
Let's go. Thanks for that input. Let's go to Cornelius in San Francisco. Hi, Cornelius.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for paying attention to how this is impacting on the gay and lesbian community. But it's very frustrating that much of the mainstream media, including NPR, has persisted in connecting the killings to ISIS terrorism and quote-unquote security breaches, and it's particularly when they talk to national politicians. But given that the shooter's ex-wife has talked about his physical violence towards her, even his imprisoning of her, why has the domestic violence connection not been further discussed, and how a person with that type of history has been able to get weapons? Did the FBI even talk to his ex-wife when they were investigating him? So that's just a question that I pose.
Trevor?
So we don't know if the FBI interviewed his ex-wife or if the FBI was even aware of his domestic violence with his wife. There's no court record in Florida suggesting any kind of domestic violence. There were no criminal charges that we've been able to find or police reports against Mateen. I have not been able to get his marriage file yet. I'm sure there's reporters beating me to this very minute at the St. Lucie County Courthouse that are going through it today. So it'll be interesting to see if that there's any indication in his divorce file of the domestic violence. But, you know, it's plausible that the government and authorities became aware of the domestic violence at the same time the rest of us did when his wife gave the interview for the media. You know, there are mechanisms in place to prevent someone convicted of domestic violence from obtaining a firearm immediately, and that seems to be a moot issue here, because from what we can tell in the records, there wasn't any authorities were not aware of the domestic violence at the time that he purchased these guns.
We just got an email from Brenda. She says, along with such unfettered access to guns and ammunition, to hear the blowback from gun owners decrying regulation is unconscionable. And she says, by the way, a friend has said, so where were those guys with guns who were supposed to stop this one guy? More guns is not the answer. In fact, it's truly more about the ammo and who's making money with more shootings and more war for that matter. So again, this goes into a larger conversation about the ability to create this kind of mass shooting incident. And, you know, my thinking was, if it wasn't enough that more than two dozen first graders were killed in cold blood at Sandy Hook, if that didn't move the needle, what can? And I'm wondering, is this the turning point? Is this the pivot? Carlos, do you have any thoughts at all on that?
Well, I mean, I sure hope so. That's my first thought. I would really hope so. You know, I think that I think as our country moves in the direction of, you know, we are not going to allow this to happen. We do not want to see this happen over and over again. You know, I think, you know, the calls to name the NRA as a terrorist organization, you know, and calls to push the needle farther around gun control, I think we should really support those. I think the LGBTQ community needs to come out and, you know, and support those like never before, you know. And, you know, being an Oakland resident, being, you know, in the city that celebrates and embraces diversity and inclusivity, you know, one of the most diverse cities in the country, you know, and a city that has been affected by gun violence for years, you know, I think this is an example of how people can come together and really solve issues. You know, Oakland is a place where diversity is celebrated, and I think through that diversity, through that intersectionality of our issues of, you know, around gun violence, that I think, you know, we do push harder, we do push further, and, you know, I hope to see the change that we can actually, you know, achieve.
And Monica, we have an email from Monica. She says the conversation now is centering around the shootings as a terrorist act. However, we all know it is relatively easy for someone to claim a connection with any type of negative politics and ISIS. I thought it was interesting, Trevor, that ISIS quickly claimed responsibility for this. Is there any reason to think that that is not the case, that they are simply piggybacking on the tragedy? Or is it credible to believe that this really was was something that they could rightfully claim as they're doing?
You know, it's a complicated question in the sense that as far as what the authorities have said publicly, that they cannot substantiate any link between Omar Mateen and the Islamic State. But as I mentioned earlier in the show, you know, the Islamic State model is really to inspire people to commit these acts of violence without necessarily being in touch with them. So, you know, under that model, it is plausible that the Islamic State really can take credit for this, even though they had no, possibly no knowledge that it was going to happen before it actually did. You know, the other thing worth thinking about is whether someone like Omar Mateen was really acting out of, you know, inspiration of a hate crime, right? Like he as his father said, he saw two men kissing in Miami and he went over the, you know, he went crazy and wanted to commit violence, just like a non-Muslim would want to commit violence, and that would be labeled a hate crime. Potentially, Omar Mateen was inspired more from his hatred of gays than he was for the Islamic State, but knowing that he could call 911 and say the Islamic State would cause a media storm around his case and get what he wants, which is more and more attention to his very horrific crime, you know, it's possible that's also a part of this too, that his real inspiration was kind of homophobia and hatred of gays, but, you know, he knew that that kind of dovetailed into what the Islamic State believed, and that claiming credit to the Islamic State would get him more attention. You know, I really don't know the answer to that, and I don't think anyone does at this point, you know, what his true motivation was. But, you know, that's the kind of vexing issue in discussing kind of inspirational crimes, is that, you know, was it truly inspired by the Islamic State, or is he just piggybacking on the hysteria we all have about the Islamic State to draw more attention to, you know, what is a very horrific crime that he committed?
I want to be, you know, I also want to be very clear. You know, one thing that we have seen and one thing that our community has spoken out against is the numerous politicians and elected officials who, you know, are not saying that this happened in a gay establishment. They're not saying it happened in a gay club, you know. And I think that the quickness to make this an act of Islamic terrorism or Islamic extremism is indicative of some of the homophobia that exists with our own elected officials, that exists within our own society, that if we can make this about Islamic extremism, we don't have to talk about the homophobia that exists within our own society and our own communities.
Well, there certainly is. It's interesting to watch the reactions from the politicians in Florida. They all weighed in, and certainly politics has crept into it. I kind of always felt, watching the presidential race unfold, that we were possibly one major terrorist act away from a Donald Trump presidency. And, you know, is this it? Is this the act that perhaps Trump supporters have been waiting for, Carlos?
I don't know. I honestly don't know many Trump supporters. You know, I think that this is, I think the opposite will happen. I think that, you know, a majority of Americans and many people across the country see this as an act of hate, see this as, you know, a tragic incident that was caused by gun violence. And I think that people across the country, you know, if they are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, or straight allies, they are coming together behind the LGBTQ community, and they're not going to stand for this. And so I think the opposite may happen. And, you know, I think someone like Donald Trump is an opportunist and is taking the opportunity to you know, propel his campaign forward. But I don't think it's going to have the desired effect.
So you think there's possibility for an alliance being created between the LGBT community and the Muslim community, perhaps, as a result of this?
Well, for one, I think in many respects that alliance already exists. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are, you know, I know many members of the LGBTQ community that are Muslim, you know, and are practicing. And I know folks, you know, in the Muslim community who are allies of the LGBTQ community. So I think those alliances already exist, and I think those alliances are important. And, you know, I do think those bonds will be further strengthened.
And I think President Obama was quick to call this what it was, an act of terror and an act of hate. Just got an email from Brenda. She says, I think it is misguided to say this is a mental health issue. It's flat out hate. Always sorry to hear it being used as an excuse. There's a whole swath of people suffering with mental health issues who don't go around committing mass shootings. We hope that you've had an opportunity to weigh in today, and I want to give you an opportunity, Trevor, to have last thoughts on the issue of the shootings and the implications, the national security implications, gun law implications, the nationwide implications of the shooting. Trevor?
Right. I mean, I think what is so extraordinary about this is that it really ticks several, like, really awful boxes. One, that it's the worst terrorist attack since 9/11, that it's the deadliest attack on a gay target, and it is in the nation's history, and it is also the worst mass shooting in our nation's history. And I'd like to think that a case like this will, you know, give our nation a reason to question, are we using the most effective counterterrorism measures? Are we identifying people who are threats early enough, given the very invasive surveillance the government now has? And are we using the kind of wisest, you know, gun control policy? You know, just this morning, for example, Senator Marco Rubio of Florida said that, you know, even if, you know, guns like this weren't available, people like the shooter would have been able to buy them on the black market, just like what happened in Europe. And I'm not so sure that's true. And I think it's plausible that, you know, for the most part, if these guns weren't available, that there would be less access to them, and someone like Omar Mateen would have a greater difficulty finding them. But I think, you know, there are a number of concerns.
Mm-hmm. I want to make sure Carlos has maybe 15, 20 seconds. Carlos, to weigh in, please.
Yeah, absolutely. I really want to, you know, show the support for the LGBT community, and I think that we have really done that. I also want to be sensitive about the language that we're using about the mass shooting. I really want to say that the Wounded Knee Massacre was the worst mass shooting in American history, even though this is, you know, obviously sensitive to our community today. But I want to remember that.
Thank you.
We
appreciate that. Thank you, Carlos Uribe, co-chair of Oakland Pride, for joining us. Also, Trevor Aronson, writer for The Intercept. And we thank you for joining us, for your emails and your calls. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This has been Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with award-winning journalist Ben Ehrenreich about his new book, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine. Ehrenreich spent 3 years traveling and reporting from the occupied West Bank. In his book, he details the complexities of everyday life under occupation and what he calls the giant humiliation machine that controls their lives. We hope you'll join the conversation on the next Your Call with Renee Kemp and you.